Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president had a press conference on the oil spill today. The key words you need to know, everybody, are suspend, cancel, and moratorium. There's not going to be anybody drilling anywhere offshore for a while. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 27th of May, and it is good, as always, to have you with us. President Obama took to the East Room at the White House this afternoon for his press conference. He established his theme pretty early on.
The American people should know that from the moment this disaster began, the federal government has been in charge of the response effort. As far as I'm concerned, BP is responsible for this horrific disaster, and we will hold them fully accountable on behalf of the United States, as well as the people and communities victimized by this tragedy.
And then it was as simple as one.
We will suspend the planned exploration of two locations off the coast of Alaska.
Two.
We will cancel the pending lease sale in the Gulf of Mexico and the proposed lease sale off the coast of Virginia.
Three.
We will continue the existing moratorium and suspend the issuance of new permits to drill new deepwater wells for 6 months.
And four.
We will suspend action on 33 deepwater exploratory wells currently being drilled in the Gulf of Mexico.
With those as the new ground rules, then, at least for the time being, what of our domestic oil supply and the companies that drill for it? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more.
A moratorium on new deepwater wells won't be felt in the U.S. economy for a while. Tom Wallen, the president of Energy Intelligence, says wells being drilled today are for domestic supplies several years down the road.
It casts a shadow on future U.S. oil supply out a year, two, three, four, 5 years from now. I think one of the things that's becoming very clear to the industry is that there's going to be a lot tougher regulation, there are going to be higher costs, there's going to be a lot more scrutiny, it's going to take longer to get projects developed, it's going to cost more. All of these things are going to slow down supply.
A six-month shutdown should result in a production drop of 200,000 or 300,000 barrels a day by the year 2014, says Deutsche Bank energy analyst Adam Siminski. That shortfall could easily be covered by additional imports, but it'll mean fewer American jobs and less income for the government.
Government gets about $3 billion a year in royalties and $9 billion a year in corporate taxes from developments in the deep water.
As for the industry, analysts say global oil companies can weather the temporary slowdown in the U.S., but Shell Oil, which has been betting big on expanding production in the eastern Gulf of Mexico and on Alaska's North Slope, will be hit particularly hard by a moratorium. Shell had been hoping to start drilling in the Arctic this summer and had bet on Congress opening oil leases off the western coast of Florida. David Knapp with Global Oil Market Analysis says that looks like a bad bet now.
The eastern Gulf of Mexico looked like it had some good prospectivity in terms of gas. And I think what the spill has done is the politics of that have taken that off the table. So companies that were very interested in developing that probably are going to have to rethink that.
If foreign sources of oil step into the breach, prices won't necessarily rise, at least in the short run. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All right, this is going to come a little bit out of left field, but have you read any good financial statements lately? I ask because some banks that used to seem kind of shaky have been looking better based on their latest books. But we learned the hard way the past couple of years that you can't necessarily take those books to the bank. So corporate accounting rule setters are suggesting it's time for a change. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Buried in Bank of America's financial statement is a footnote. Loans it includes in its bottom line might actually be worth $24 billion less if it had to sell those assets today. At Wells Fargo, the shortfall could be $21 billion. Under current rules, the banks aren't required to show the current market value of their outstanding loans in their bottom line, so investors have to try to figure out the fine print. John Hepp follows accounting standards at the auditing firm Grant Thornton.
It a much higher level of understanding to read a financial report with these types of numbers in them. We sort of invented this other category, other comprehensive income, or incomprehensible income, as some people call it.
That kind of confusion has gotten the blame for the jitters that crippled the credit markets. Neil McGarrity speaks for the Rulemaking Financial Accounting Standards Board.
A lack of clarity and timely information about the correct value of loans wasn't helpful.
The banking industry argues it's already putting mark-to-market estimates in financial reports, and Donna Fisher of the American Bankers Association says the proposed rule would require banks to report a bottom line based on guesswork.
We go out and figure out what someone else would pay us for that loan.
Fisher warns that could cause banks to shun long-term loans in favor of less volatile short-term lending, and shrinking their bottom lines would require banks to keep more cash reserves, leaving them with less to lend. Supporters of the approach, on the other hand, say keeping more cash on hand wouldn't be such a bad thing if it helps make the banks stronger. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
My goodness, what a day on Wall Street. We will have the detail when we do the numbers. There's a manufacturing plant in southern China that's been making grisly headlines this year. 10 workers at the massive factory have killed themselves since January, the most recent just last night. While you have probably never heard of Foxconn, you may actually know it better than you think. It's the biggest contract maker of electronics in the world. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth how Foxconn's problems might affect its clients.
The name Foxconn may not mean much to you, but these names probably do. Apple, HP, Dell, Sony. Foxconn makes products for them, including the iPhone, PlayStation, and the Kindle. And those companies' reputations are on the line. Marcia Dixon's a professor at the University of Delaware. She says manufacturing plants may be thousands of miles from consumers, but what happens there matters to companies like Apple.
Who wants their company name dragged through the dirt, you know, for death, for accidents, for child labor, for excessively low wages?
She says consumers have long memories, which means companies need to pay attention to everything.
Whether it's quality specification, you know, whether it's cost, or whether it's in compliance to their standards for working conditions.
It can be hard for companies to keep track of what manufacturers are doing, though. Even before this recent series of suicides, Foxconn had been accused of mistreating its workers. Daniel Ernst is an analyst at Hudson Square Research. He follows Apple and other companies, and he says Foxconn will have to change.
The bad news is tragedy has happened. The good news is there's been a response, and the companies involved here are so large and so global that it's not easily swept under the rug.
Apple and other clients say they've toured Foxconn's facilities and are working with the company to resolve the problems there. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Today, the government gave airlines and private plane owners the specifications for some new equipment they're going to have on board by the end of the decade. Air traffic control is going to be GPS-based by 2020. It's going to save a whole lot of jet fuel because routes will be more precise. It'll reduce the risk of collisions, too, both in the air and on the runways. But that is 10 years away. So if you're looking for a faster payoff from GPS in mass transit, look no further than the city bus. Andrea Bernstein reports now from WNYC.
It's a beautiful sunny afternoon in Boston, and librarian Carolyn McIntosh is standing at a corner looking for the number 39 bus.
I just wait for it.
It runs pretty close to schedule, does it?
Well, of course not. You know, you look at the schedule, you read the time it's supposed to come. It doesn't show up that time. If you want the bus, you just wait.
That's pretty much the way it is for most bus commuters in this country. Massachusetts Department of Transportation wants that to change.
We want to know, when is the next bus actually going to show up? Not when is it scheduled to show up, but when is it actually going to show up? Where is it right now?
Chris Dempsey is Director of Innovation for the Transit Agency here. He wondered, why is it so hard to get accurate information about where the buses and trains are?
And the answer is because transit information at the MBTA and almost every other transit agency in the United States is closed.
Massachusetts began collecting GPS location data 8 years ago, but Dempsey and his colleague Joshua Robin were bothered that the public couldn't see it.
Chris and I always kind of went nuts because we would go into the operations center and we'd see all the buses on the screen and we'd say, I ride the bus every day. If only I knew that little piece of information, it would really change my life.
Robin says transit agencies aren't particularly good at developing software. So last November, he and Dempsey brought in 200 private software developers for an all-day meeting. As a pilot project, they gave them all the GPS data for 5 bus lines. Then they broke for lunch.
When we came back from lunch, someone had already built an application, a Google Earth application. And by the end of the weekend, before Chris and I got back to work on Monday, someone had already put it on a simple website.
10 days later, there was a smartphone app called Catch the Bus. A few blocks from Robin's office, we click through a couple of screens on his Android phone.
So it says the next bus is going to come in 3 or so minutes.
Soon after, a bus does pull up. We ride over to J.P. Licks, an ice cream store in the Jamaica Plain section of Boston. He shows his creation, an LED sign perched above a display of ice cream cakes.
So it says, next inbound 39 bus, 6 minutes. I don't have to guess, do I have time for another cup of coffee? Do I have time for another bagel? I know exactly when the bus is going to come. It's very reassuring.
The store manager says he's noticed more customers lingering and buying more ice cream since the LED sign went up. But the technology can be applied far beyond this shop.
All right, here it comes.
Ta-da.
Jared Egan shows me yet another new app on his iPad.
There's wow. Also on the street right now. This is the live GPS position of all the buses.
And these are the actual buses, where they are right now.
That's right.
So if we watch this, they're going to move around like kind of slow-moving ants?
Yeah.
And they do. Beginning next week, for 99 cents, Boston riders can download this app. Glenn Harnish, a local teacher, says he doesn't take the bus much now, but this app could change his mind.
I find the bus to be a little bit hard to decipher and a little bit archaic in terms of it's not very transparent exactly how it works. Having that information, I think, would make me more inclined to take the bus.
That's why San Francisco, Portland, and Chicago have already released their location data, and why New York and Washington want to. Because in this era of huge budget gaps, predictability is one new service transit agencies can offer. In Boston, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Andrea's story was part of our Transportation Nation public radio project. We've got more stories in the series on our webpage, marketplace.org. Coming up.
I'm scrolling with my finger up, down, left, right, and I just have the impression that it's endless content.
Ah, the iPad as a sales tool. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial surged 284 points today. That's 2.8%, closed at 10,258. The NASDAQ climbed 81 points, 3.7%, 2277 at the bell. The S&P 500 shot up 35 points, 3.3%, 1103 at the bell there. Financial shares banked some gains today. Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America all tacked on more than 4%. Goldman Sachs advanced more than 3.5%. BP said it made some progress stopping that oil leak. That pumped its shares up 7%. The other big oil companies were energized, too. Chevron posted a gain of nearly 4% today. ExxonMobil tacked on more than 3.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.35%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama is scheduled to head to the Gulf Coast to see the oil spill firsthand. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for April. And the bond market closes early for the holiday weekend. Is your office closing early? Can I go home early? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In Chicago today, Oprah Winfrey opened her second retail outlet. That may come as a surprise to those of us who didn't know she had a first store. This one's pretty small, a glorified kiosk, really, that she's billing as a micro salon. It's inside a mall in Chicago. But Oprah's not really one to do anything small, so you can bet there are more on the way. And we asked Jeff Horowitz what might happen as the queen of daytime TV moves from your living room to the local mall.
What's in an Oprah store anyway? Well, the first one opened 2 years ago in her Chicago studios. Mugs, umbrellas, handbags, tableware.
Pajamas! When I'm not working, ugh.
That's Oprah giving a video tour. The question is, what's not in an Oprah store? If Oprah wants to put her stamp on it, it's fair game, including crafts from South Africa, where she does charity work. The new store is much smaller, just 140 square feet, but it's her first big step into the outside brick-and-mortar world.
For a brand this large, quite frankly, I'm surprised that she never did this sooner.
Retail analyst Kristen Bentz says Oprah is a unique brand. On one hand, she's wealthy and awash in desirable merchandise to recommend. But somehow, she does it without making you jealous.
Women want to be her, but at the same time, they're not threatened by her.
John Bressler is president of the soap and fragrance company Lofco. 3 years ago, Oprah gave everyone in her studio audience a bar to take home.
She put it in front of everybody in America and had them craving something that they had never seen before.
Bressler sees Oprah's endorsement as a helpful shortcut for shoppers.
There's a lot of product out in the market, and I think consumers are looking for guidance on what to buy.
One thing to know about the Oprah stores is that they sell Oprah-branded stuff. Will Oprah fans like Julie Peterson follow her as she moves from endorsing other people's products to hawking her own?
That I might be a little more skeptical about.
Then again, Oprah is a pretty good saleswoman. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
The Museum of Contemporary Art here in Los Angeles is getting a new director next month. It's worth a mention because, for one, the museum made huge art world headlines 2 years ago for its budget problems. And second, the new guy, New York gallery owner Jeffrey Deitch, knows the business of art as well as the art itself. Our occasional commentator on the art world, independent dealer Richard Polsky, is here to discuss. Richard, hello again.
Good to be here.
So this guy, Jeffrey Deitch, is a Harvard MBA. He is an art dealer. He's a gallery owner. What is he going to bring to the Museum of Contemporary Art here in Los Angeles?
Well, hopefully fiscal responsibility. This is a museum that has a reputation for always being in trouble financially. You know, a museum director these days wears a lot of hats. You're trying to pamper the trustees to keep the cash flow. You're trying to add membership. You're trying to create shows that bring in people where people want to see it. There are so many entertainment options out there that museums have got to do something to compete. Deitch knows how to do this. He started out creating the first art investment program for Citibank, which allowed collectors to use art as collateral to purchase more art. Nobody thought that way. The idea of a bank lending money on a painting was outrageous. But the other half of him is out on the streets, hanging out in the East Village, meeting people like Basquiat, meeting people like Jeff Koons. He is a little controversial. He always wears the same outfit and the same weird glasses. He's a bit of a character. You can't miss the guy.
When we think of museum directors, though, we are thinking Philippe de Montebello, the guy from the Metropolitan New York, very patrician, academic. This is not who we have here.
It's a good point. The whole museum world never mixed art and money. It was considered a taboo. Museums hired scholars, but it's changed mostly because these directors are under incredible pressure to make money. There is a precedent for what Deitch is doing. There was a gentleman named Thomas Hoving, who ran the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Hoving was really the person responsible for the blockbuster mentality at a major museum. He was the one who ushered in this whole idea of a museum is not just for the elite. Let's get the people in who pay admission fees, buy things at the gift shops. And when he did the first King Tut show, it completely changed the museum world. So there is a precedent for bringing in someone like Deitch, who is a bit of a showman.
Is a museum of contemporary art maybe the best place to try this kind of change in leadership? I mean, you know, modern art's all about taking risks and finding new things. And might the crowd that likes modern art be more receptive to that?
Absolutely. L.A. is the perfect laboratory. The first show that Deitch has curated or co-curated is going to be about the work of Dennis Hopper. Perfect call, given it's Los Angeles, given the fact Hopper was an early pop art collector, so he has credibility, he was there early. We know he's a controversial and very well-liked actor. So here, Deitch comes in, already he's doing a crowd-pleasing show.
How long do you think he has? I mean, is there a time limit on his, you know, window for success?
Time will tell whether he represents the new paradigm as to what a museum director should be and will be. I see it as a big success.
Richard Polsky comes by every now and then to talk about art and the business thereof. His most recent book is called I Sold Andy Warhol Too Soon. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Technology news of the week so far is that Apple has finally put Microsoft in the rearview mirror. It happened yesterday. Apple's market capitalization, that is, the value of all of its outstanding shares, beat Microsoft's by a couple of billion dollars. Really cool new hardware beating out stale-ish old software is one reason why that happened. Another reason is that businesses, retailers and marketers especially, are finding all kinds of things they can do with Apple's mobile toys. Because mobile's where it's at in marketing today. Retailers trying to figure out how to turn those toys into bigger sales. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports now on one company that is diving right in.
If you locked a mad scientist in a room and asked her to create the ultimate marketing device, she might come back with something that would follow you around, track your desires, slip into your pocket, and would always be on. In short, she'd hand you a cell phone.
There's incredible possibilities of what this little square can do in the future.
Ivy Ross isn't exactly a mad scientist. She's the vice president of global marketing at Gap. And truth be told, her ideal marketing gadget would have one thing your phone doesn't have, a nice big touch screen, kind of like an iPad.
You know, you can explore and slide and move, and then you find something that interests you, and you press, and all of a sudden, you know, a video goes on, and then you press again, and you can buy what's in the video. So just kind of keep going deeper.
Ross thinks tablet computers are a marketing paradise in the making.
It's almost like Alice in Wonderland falling through the rabbit hole.
So Gap's jumped in and developed one of the first retail apps for the iPad. Gap won't say how much it spent, but experts say a slick iPad app could cost more than $500,000 to develop. And right now, only a handful of retailers have taken the plunge. Gap's app delivers a full immersion experience in Gap World, a place where everyone is young, hot, and looks fabulous in jeans. Julie Osk is the queen bee of mobile marketing research at Forrester. I asked her to check it out.
I'm scrolling with my finger up, down, left, right, and I just have the impression that it's endless content.
Endless Gap content.
No, you know, the graphics are good, you know, the branding is good.
They're music videos. You can hear contestants from Project Runway discuss the virtues of denim and see celeb photos. It's all clickable, interactive, and easy to email to friends. But unless you're, like, really into jeans, why would you come here? Osk says building a marketing campaign around a brand new technology is treacherous. No one really knows yet how people use their iPads. And Gap's media-rich app design makes it a space hog and a pain to download.
It's at least bigger than AT&T wants me to download over their very crowded 3G network here in San Francisco. I then had to go three steps back, find a local wireless Wi-Fi network, and connect.
Osk says companies need to figure out what's going to make their app worth the hassle for consumers.
When it comes to mobile, it's got to be simple and it has to be contextual. And by contextual, it needs to be personal, it needs to be tied to my location, it needs to be tied to my past behavior.
Ask says mobile marketers need to give you what you want when you want it. On the iPhone, Gap sends customers special discounts when they're near a store. In the industry, they call that luring you across the lease line. Target lets you scan barcodes and check prices. There's a bank that lets you photograph checks with your phone and then deposit them instantly via email. Ask says this is the kind of mobile customer service where the iPad's probably headed. But for now, Gap's Ivy Ross says they're just offering consumers a good time and maybe a chance to shop.
With technology, you just have to make a decision to jump in and go on the journey with the technology and with the consumer.
And Ross is watching. Marketers like her will be recording everything.
The great thing for us is that we measure how many people open videos, how many people listen to the Truth and Salvage song, how many people, you know, clicked on celebrities. And then we're even able to tell how many people, you know, looked at the clothing and then chose to click through to actually purchase.
So even if this app is a sales flop for Gap, the company will still end up one step closer to understanding exactly how to make mobile marketing pay. From Menlo Park, California, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, we will end where we began today with oil, the kind that is safely in barrels, though, not leaking into the Gulf of Mexico. Crude closed up almost 4% today, $74.50 at the close in New York. Oil prices have been tracking the ebb and flow in the stock markets pretty closely the past couple of weeks. But one other thing might have helped today's bump. NOAA, the government's official weather agency, issued its forecast for the coming hurricane season this morning. It's going to be a rough one, they said. That could give oil rigs in the Gulf some problems and lead to supply shortages. Of course, getting tomorrow's weather right is tricky enough, let alone a whole season. So take that one for what it's worth. But for now, that is Marketplace. American Public Media is the company. Today, the Dow jumped 284 points, 2.8%. The NASDAQ packed on 81 points, 3.7%. The S&P 500 up 35 points, 3.3%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. Next time on this broadcast, why your local hospital needs good and frequent advertising.
Insurance companies, how much they're willing to pay a hospital depends on how much their enrollees or their enrollees' employers want that hospital to be in their network.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.